In Eskridge, Kansas, population 500, a tornado siren stands tall and proud like a monument to inclement weather. Interlocking metal planks climb high above the ranch houses below, with a bellowing round of megaphone-looking sirens, the crowning glory up top. Every small town in Kansas has something like this, and photographer Lily Brooks went all over the state to pay homage to the way we navigate weather in this part of the country. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're going to talk about that, starting with photographer Lily Brooks. Hi, Lily.
Hi there. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us. First of all, tell me about those tornado sirens you went around looking at here in Kansas.
Well, it started because I was driving through Eskridge. I was doing an artist residency at the Vollen store, which is just outside Alma. And I was driving through Eskridge one day, and I saw the siren on top of the volunteer fire station there, and I didn't know what it was. I was with my boyfriend, who's a native Kansan, and he said, well, it's a tornado siren. And I said, that thing is just beautiful. I want to make a photograph of it. And I had been working on this long-term project about our relationship to weather and climate, and so it seemed like the perfect subject matter and led me on this hunt throughout Kansas for the past 2 years to photograph as many as I can.
I want to get back to that, but you are not from Kansas, and I'm curious about your background and what weather might have had to do with your upbringing, your culture growing up.
Sure. Well, I grew up outside Providence, Rhode Island, just over the border in Massachusetts, in a town that's relatively rural, or at least it was when I was growing up. I grew up in an old farmhouse, and so though my parents weren't farmers, I was out in the landscape all the time, and I think that shaped my relationship to the landscape and my interest in the natural world. But really, the transition happened when I moved from Boston to Texas in 2011 to begin my master's degree at the University of Texas at Austin. I happened to move during this incredible heat wave and drought. That summer of 2011 in Austin, Texas, I think there were 90 days over 100 degrees. And so for me, coming from New England and never really having lived in the South, it was a shock to my system. And I thought that I would make photographs about the heat because it was sort of the only thing I could think about.
How do you photograph heat?
Well, the first photograph that I made was literally a photograph of a weather map from a newspaper. So I use a large format camera, which is a bulky, heavy thing and involves me being underneath a big, heavy cloth when I'm making photographs. So I couldn't imagine going out into the heat to make a picture of the heat. So instead, I bought a copy of a newspaper and I cut out the weather map on what was to that day the hottest day of the year. So it's all sort of pinks and reds. I pasted it to the inside of my nice air-conditioned apartment and made a picture of it. And for me, it sort of stood for this calamity that was going on around me, but also the way that the weather is part of our daily routine, and maybe sometimes the only time that we really consider the natural world in a day is when we're thinking about how uncomfortable we are.
Well, and also just that, I don't know, it seems like you were kind of pinned inside and by the weather, and your relationship to it turned into a relationship with air conditioning and a map and the color coding on that map.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, I think that one thing that happened was that photograph sat on my studio wall for a few months. And during those months, it continued to be oppressively hot in Austin. And there was also this catastrophic drought happening, worst drought that had hit the region since the 1950s. And so the ranchers around me were having to sell off their cattle, for instance. There was a wildfire in Bastrop, Texas, which is just outside Austin, that burned 1,600 homes. And so while I was sort of moaning and groaning about my discomfort, these greater catastrophes were happening that had more to do with maybe climate change and the long-term effects of weather patterns than daily weather.
You know, a friend of mine from LA had not experienced weather or like this kind of weather that we have in this part of the country until she moved here. And in her first year, she said she thought that our weather was barbaric. And the term really stuck with me. We like to think society has advanced to where we're not subject to the elements. But I feel like your photographs and these tornado sirens and all these relics of our human relationships with weather tell a different story.
Well, I think that that's something that I'm really interested in, is our vulnerability. I mean, I think we are responsible and also vulnerable to climate and the extreme weather that happens as a result of climate change. And so for me, like the tornado sirens are these little beacons. They're like a little reminder of the threat. Even in these scenes that seem like perfect little small town America, there's this reminder that this threat is looming. And where I live now in Louisiana, I feel very vulnerable, and that the people around me are very vulnerable to climate change. I mean, we're sort of on the front lines here. And that's been really humbling and interesting. It's a wonderful place for me to work.
You know, I want you to tell me more about the tornado sirens you saw throughout Kansas and who mans them, like what their role is in these communities.
Well, it's interesting. You know, when I saw that first tornado siren in Eskridge, I really wanted to get up onto the roof of the volunteer fire station to make the photograph. I wanted to be closer to the thing. And so I knocked on the door and nobody was there. And I went to the bank next door and they sent me down the street to find this, to find the volunteer fire chief who was working the cash register at the lumber yard. And he's this gentleman named Jack Foster. And he sort of, I explained the project to him and he was a little suspicious, but he said, well, if you want to get on top of that fire station, go ahead, just try not to fall off. And then he offered me his ladder and I continued to explain the project to him. And he said, well, you probably want to see my weather station then. And I said, well, yes, I really do. And it turned out that he's a volunteer. He and his wife both are volunteer observers. And they have a little weather station in their backyard from which they transmit the data that they observe on a daily basis.
Why do they do that?
You know, I think they would have to answer that. But I don't think it's an uncommon fascination, especially for people who live in places where the weather, it can be barbaric or dramatic. And have a big effect over the outcome of people's lives. And I think that Kansas is that place. So a lot of the meteorologists, professional meteorologists that I meet, say they have been fascinated by the weather since they were children. I mean, I don't think it's an uncommon preoccupation.
When you traveled this part of the country, particularly as an outsider, but doing so like on a scavenger hunt almost for tornado sirens in small towns in Kansas, what was it like to see this part of the country that way?
It was really wonderful for me. I have to say that, yes, I'm really unfamiliar with the Midwest. And well, first of all, I really fell in love with the plains themselves. I've always been most captivated by the ocean as a landscape because I grew up close to it. But I have to say that the plains and the prairie are just as beautiful and sort of reactive to the weather and light as the ocean. So that's one thing that I discovered. But I also took a lot of pleasure in being able to turn my camera on what felt like a very American landscape in a time when America seemed to be at a point of transition, and where it was really fruitful for me to look at that landscape and the built environment there and think about our history and the way that small town America has changed in the last 50 years. especially in Kansas, I think about the way that corporate agriculture has changed those towns, and the populations have diminished so substantially. So it felt like I was able to talk about a lot of things in the photographs at once and learn a lot about those kinds of places.
You started your research here right after the Anderson Creek fire, which is the biggest wildfire ever to ravage the state. Mm-hmm. It burned more than 400,000 acres, and then there was snow like a week later. This was in March. Mm-hmm. How did that recent memory shape what you saw and heard about weather in Kansas?
Well, it was certainly a part of the conversations that I had with people when I was talking about the work I was doing. I didn't look directly at that event while I was there, but I think that it maybe helped me to get access to places because people were it was at the forefront of their minds. And I think that when people feel that their story needs to be told, they are maybe more willing to let an outsider in.
Yeah, I want to turn to Mary Knapp. She is a Kansas State climatologist, and she oversees a network of volunteer weather people, regular citizens who track the weather from their own weather stations scattered throughout the state. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
You know, as a native Kansan and weather expert, do Lily's observations about Kansas and the weather ring true for you?
In many cases, I think one thing that's very interesting is that in Kansas, we do have a long record of observers that have volunteered to make these observations and record them. And they do it day in and day out, whether the weather is exciting or not exciting. And that makes it a very valuable resource when people start talking about climate change to look at what were the records in 1856 in Manhattan or 1863 out in Tribune. How has it changed? How has it been influenced? And again, a shout out to those hundreds of volunteers who do this on a regular basis because they are interested in the weather and they're interested in sharing that information with the rest of society. They don't write it on a calendar and put it in the barn or by the refrigerator. They actually actively put that out and make it available for others that might be interested in that. We have in Kansas, the volunteer network that Lily was talking about is the National Weather Service Co-op Observer Network, which goes back again, like I said, to the very beginnings of the state. But there's also another network of rain gauge volunteers, and that's the CoCoRods Community Collaborative Rain, Hail, and Snow Network. And they concentrate specifically on the liquid portion of the weather. And that becomes very important when we're looking at both sides of the spectrum, whether it be drought or whether it be flooding.
I am fascinated that this tradition that goes back to the foundings of the state of Kansas, I mean, that's a long time. And you can kind of imagine that at that time, probably that was the only way to find out the weather is to have individuals just scattered throughout the state doing that. It's a little more surprising to me that that tradition continues today.
It really is, I don't think, unusual, and it isn't unique to Kansas. There are volunteers all over the country that do that. But again, because weather impacts everyone's lives, whether you be from an urban area or a rural community, there is a lot of interest in it, and we only need to look at the next round of winter storms that is hitting New England to note that. And again, there are a lot of modern methods coming up where we look at satellite imagery that can take pictures of the down to the ground. You can actually see the flooding rivers, all sorts of things like that. But it's vital to have that individual on the ground to validate that information that's coming from the skies. So having that network becomes extremely valuable. It gets more difficult in the modern age simply because we're a more transitory society. People don't grow up in the same town that they were born in very often. It's much more likely that they will move multiple times in their lifetime as they pursue careers and opportunities around not only the state but around the world. So it gets more of a challenge to have the continuity that we have with some of our long-term stations.
You know, so K-State is a National Weather Service co-op observation site, and I'm wondering if you can tell me what you do there.
What we do there is that we go out every morning and take the high and low temperature and the precipitation, being the liquid equivalent of the rainfall, plus any snow measurements that might happen to be there. And that happens every day, 7 days a week, holidays and spring break included. And then we also make any notes of special events. So if there's been an ice storm, if there's been wind damage, if it's unusually high, and we send that out to the National Weather Service. We also send it out to local media so that they can keep up to date with whether or not this is a particularly unique event. Is it a record high? Is it a record low? How does that compare to our past events? And that is basically the components of a co-op station.
Do you feel connected to the people who were manning this station, you know, years and years ago?
Oh, yes, definitely. And you can look and see the observation forms that they submitted in the early days. It was paper forms that were mailed into the central reporting areas. Now it's all done online, but those online forms are still available. And it's really interesting to go back and note where they may have talked about, okay, we saw the aurora borealis on this particular date. Another one was when Anderson Hall on campus was struck by lightning, or when there was a huge number of grasshoppers that came through the area. So there are anecdotes about events around them in addition to just the plain dry facts of the weather.
How did you get interested in the weather?
Well, it was kind of a roundabout pattern. In high school, I did a science project on weather modification and connected with the climatologist Dean Bark at the time as I was doing my research on that. By the way, I decided that it was not a area that would be people would want to pursue very much simply because of the legalities that would be involved. Somebody would sue if you stole their rain, that kind of thing. And then I went into agronomy for my career. Went to the Dominican Republic as a Peace Corps volunteer in rice extension work and encountered my first hurricane, which was a very amazing comparison. Lots of time had wondered what would be the difference between a hurricane and a tornado. And of course, hurricane, the extent is much larger, but the wait time for its arrival is much, much longer. We had a week where we were sitting there knowing it was coming and there wasn't anything that could be done about it.
So in Kansas, like, do you feel like the weather here and the particularities of weather, not just tornadoes, but other things, really shape the culture here in some way, how people live in this state?
I think it does to a certain extent. But again, I think the weather and climate shape wherever people live. It's just a different influence in the particular region that you're in. And in Kansas, we have that unique blend of extremes on all ends that make it an interesting challenge.
Lily Brooks, you have, first of all, you've been taking photographs documenting like the vestiges of people's obsession with tracking weather over time, mm-hmm. all over the country. I'm curious how the kinds of things people do in Kansas today and have done in Kansas throughout the history of the state tie into what you've seen all over the country.
Well, I could say that, I actually visited Mary at K-State in 2016 when I was first there, and they were doing some experiments modeling different conditions for drought and things like that with growing wheat fields. I believe it was, Mary, maybe you could correct me on that, but I love thinking about the tie to agriculture and how important and critical the weather is to the outcome of an agricultural practice. And at one weather station in New England that I visited many times, it's called the Blue Hill Meteorological Observatory. It's the oldest continuously operating weather station in North America, and it's just outside Boston. There, they're conducting regular, very sophisticated meteorology, but they also track this patch of blueberries that's been cultivated since the turn of the century. And so every springtime, volunteers or scientists are going out every day and searching for the first ripe blueberry and making a note of when they find that first ripe blueberry. And so I just thought there was something so kind of poetic and human about that. It feels so, I don't know, tactile
Yeah,
and
it's not like
relatable.
a blip on a radar.
Yes. Yeah, it's very concrete.
Mary, is there any tradition like that in Kansas?
There are a number of traditions like that. One is looking for Kansas, it's the green up. When does the winter wheat come out of dormancy and start showing that green in the fields? That is on the cultivated agriculture side. In the Flint Hills, it again is green up, but it's when does the grass start coming out of dormancy and becoming active?
When KCUR Central Standard returns, we are going to bring a storm chaser in on this conversation. He photographs the Kansas sky, and we want to know how weather shapes your life, especially the threat of crazy weather, your life, your community. 816-235-2888. We'd love to hear those stories. I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll be right back. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman talking about the weather, specifically how it shapes the lives of Kansans in ways we don't always appreciate. This conversation is inspired by the photographs of tornado sirens that are now on view at the Volan Store Gallery in the Flint Hills. We've been talking to the photographer behind that show, Lily Brooks, as well as a weather expert from K-State. Hi again, Lily.
Hello.
And hello, Mary Knapp.
Hello.
Now let's bring Stephen Locke in on this. He's a storm chaser and photographer who focuses on the Kansas sky. And Stephen, you've said that tornado sirens are the song of your people.
Indeed, they sure are. Good morning, Gina.
Hi, what do you mean by that?
Tornado sirens are the song of my people. If I'm speaking generally, I think, a little bit about the people who live in Tornado Alley, but I'm also speaking more specifically about the subculture of storm chasers, people who are drawn to severe weather every spring, and people who experience a visceral reaction, an excited visceral reaction, to the sound of civil defense sirens, even if they are just the monthly test on first Wednesdays.
So you get excited when you hear that test?
Indeed, I do, yes.
You know,
It's, I'm sorry, go ahead.
no, please, you, sorry.
Well, yes, the sound of the siren, even if it's just a weekly test during the wintertime, is just, that sound results in a visceral reaction. It reminds me of the warm spring days when the humidity and the instability is in the air. It reminds me of storm chases. And it's just it's a call to attention, a call to presence, and just very much reminds me of storm chasing and all of the excitement that goes with that.
So for a lot of people, we've heard Lily say that those tornado sirens in different Kansas towns are beacons, that they're a reminder of a threat. They're a reminder of something else for you. I mean, they're a source of excitement. And when you say that there's humidity and instability in the air and that that's like a positive thing for you, can you describe that a little bit more? I mean, what was your first time chasing a storm?
Well, I grew up in Kansas, and so the weather was always just something that was a part of my springtime experience here. But eventually, as a professional photographer, and then ultimately as a professional storm chaser, I just very much became drawn to going out into Kansas and I began considering storms, particularly supercell thunderstorms, as part of the landscape out there. Kansas is a minimalist landscape, and I regard it as kind of a blank canvas on which this drama plays out every spring as the supercell thunderstorms develop and the occasional tornado.
You know, it sounds like, yeah, it sounds very different to hear you describing a tornado than to hear the description of a tornado on the news when you're looking at the wreckage from it.
Well, yes, I approach it as art. I don't really approach it as something necessarily to induce an adrenaline high, although I'm sure there was a certain amount of adrenaline involved with it. But I've always, my still photography is intended to be artistic for collectors, and my cinematography is intended to be something of a very high quality for the film industry and television. And so the art aspect of this is very important to me. So I approach these storms as something beautiful, and beautiful to be recorded and documented. And that's the paradox of storms. Storms are simultaneously beautiful and destructive, as are most powerful things in the natural world. So my job out there as a artist and a storm chaser is to find a balance between the destructiveness of it and the beauty of it. Lightning can be a very beautiful thing, but where the lightning strikes, almost certainly some damage has occurred. So that's the paradox, paradox of these. Of these storms.
Stephen, I'm going to get right back to you, but I am curious about Mary Knapp's perspective on that. I mean, is that a paradox for you as a climatologist, as someone who also spends your days in awe of weather?
Right. And my perspective is a little bit different in that I'm more of a stationary reporting. I do collect data from around the state, but my emphasis is at my local station and not necessarily following the storm, and that would be comparable to a storm spotter versus a storm chaser in the severe weather world, where they look at a certain slice of the landscape and look for approaching threats and changing patterns, whereas the storm chaser follows that and sets up to take, again, the image of that storm as it builds, as it develops, and as it finally dissipates.
You know, Stephen goes out into the weather when there is a tornado, which is the opposite of what most of us are inclined to do and also told to do. But in less severe weather, is there still also kind of that dynamic, this tension between wanting to be shielded from the weather and wanting to experience it?
I think definitely, and that you can look at something as simple as a snowstorm and wanting to be out and capturing the beauty of the snowflakes and yet realizing the hazards that accumulate on the roadways and driving in it, in a rainstorm where you're enjoying those life-giving drops of water but looking at it collecting into a storm sewer and becoming a raging torrent that washes away cars and property. So again, there's the duality of that, even in the most innocuous, where you're looking at, oh, it's a nice sunny clear day, and you're thinking, oh, it's beautiful, until you realize it's been 90 days since it's rained, and that nice clear today is another day of drought.
And a problem for a farmer.
Problem for a farmer, problem for a homeowner, it becomes a problem all around.
Well, Stephen, you know, you partnered on a book called Chasing Weather with a poet, actually a former Kansas poet laureate, and together you do kind of tell a story of a community shaped by weather.
Yes, and that's another example of how I'm efforting to strike a balance between the beauty and the drama of storms. In fact, your producer referred to my storm photography as, I think he actually used the word insane was the most available adjective to him. And so here in our book, we have the combination of my insane photography and the poetry of Karen Marion Goldberg. So once again, it's that drama balanced with beauty.
But what is that story that you're telling, do you think, in this book?
Well, we are telling the story of how weather has shaped who we are as Midwesterners and those who live in Tornado Alley. The weather shapes us. Most people I talk to are very much fascinated with storms, even if they are not storm chasers or spotters, just ordinary, just plain folks report loving thunderstorms. A lot of people just say, you know, I love thunderstorms. And I think that's because thunderstorms are kind of a call to presence. If you hear the sound of thunder, thunder interrupts the busyness of the mind and the normal drama and monkey mind thinking that we experience day to day, and that thunder will just be a sudden call to presence, you know, almost like a temple bell in a monastery. It makes you pause, brings you into the present moment, and for most people, that's a visceral experience that they remember and are drawn to.
It's like,
and look forward to on the rare occasion when it occurs.
I love that idea of the tornado siren kind of as our temple bells here in Kansas.
Yes, and that's why I love Lily's title, Siren Call.
Yeah.
Call to attention.
Photographer Stephen Locke, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Mary Knapp with us from K-State, thank you.
Thank you.
And Lily Brooks, thanks for inspiring this conversation.
Thank you so much. It's such an honor.
That photo exhibit, Siren Call, is on view through April 29th at the Volan store in the Flint Hills. Up next, a travel writer based in Kansas on our obsession with souvenirs. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now I'm here with travel writer Rolf Potts, whose newest book is about to hit the shelves. And it's not about the places he's visited, but what he brings home with him. The book is called Souvenir. Hi, Rolf.
Hey, Gina. Good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you, too. What is interesting to you about souvenirs? It's something that people don't give a lot of thought to.
You know, I didn't give a lot of thought to it either. At least individual souvenirs. But as I traveled over the years, actually at the end of this year, it will be my 20th year as a full-time travel writer. I've written a lot about individual journeys, but there are certain factors that connect different journeys. And I think over time, the idea of what I bring home has affected my travels, my memories, and they've sort of framed how I recall my travels over the years, and they have a sort of, they tell a story of their own that's a little bit counterintuitive, and the more I wrote the book, a little bit existential. I think the moment I knew that I had a book to write about souvenirs is when I learned that Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, when they went to Shakespeare's estate in the late 18th century, they took out a knife and carved off parts of Shakespeare's chair to take home as wood chips.
Did anyone object to that?
They didn't. It was actually part of the souvenir ritual. We think of tourism now as a mass culture phenomenon. Back then, it was an aristocratic thing, and there was no interpretive information at Stratford. And so the servants, basically, who had been bribed to let them on the estate, gave them a knife and said, this is what people do. And of course, if 10,000 people a month visit a place, then you can't really do that, or else you'd have to supply a lot of chairs.
Well, let's go back to your story. I mean, you grew up in South Central Kansas, and your first souvenir was from a trip to Chicago. It was what you thought was a seashell.
Correct. You know, I think I was 7 years old, and I saw Lake Michigan. And unlike the reservoirs in Kansas, I couldn't see the other side, and it felt like an ocean. And even though it was a clamshell, I called it a seashell, in part because I was wowed by the metropolis of Chicago, but also because I was sort of dreaming of points beyond. I sort of was hoping that someday I would see an ocean in person.
What do you, take us to that moment where you pick up this clamshell and decide to take it home, and talk to us about what you did with it and what it began.
Well, it's really interesting. The meaning of that seashell or that clamshell changed over time. I think at the time I was just excited to find anything that seemed like the natural world. I was probably in Lincoln Park in Chicago, and I tucked it away into my day pack and I displayed it proudly in my room. And I really used it as an object to dream of points beyond, which is funny because I've been a travel writer for a long time now and I've seen plenty of oceans. Interestingly, and this is something that I meditate on in the book, there was a point at which I lost track of that seashell that clamshell that meant so much to me when I was young. I think because I went to college in Oregon, I lived in Asia for a while, and the idea of dreaming about an ocean became a reality, and that object no longer served the present. And of course, now it's sort of sad that I lost track of that seashell because it reminds me of who I was when I was seven, and I think it helps me appreciate the dreams that I had when I was young that have come true in so many ways. So that's just one example of a souvenir that had very important meaning at one time, and its meaning has changed over time to the point where it became something that I could cast aside at a certain point in my life.
Right. I mean, more recently, like when you started this book, you had been collecting, sort of subconsciously collecting masks in Asia.
Yeah, that's another interesting story. And some of the social scientists who study tourism say that tourists just like masks. Cultures who don't have mask performances in their dance drama, they carve masks because tourists ask after masks, especially in continents like Africa, where there's so many cultures mixing together that, you know, one tribe might make masks because they're jealous that the tribe, you know, one valley over is selling a lot of masks. In my situation, as I was in my earliest travels through Asia, every country I went to, I would buy a dance drama mask for my collection. And after about six countries, when I got to Mongolia, I realized I didn't know why I was doing it because I wasn't going to dance dramas. I was just buying these sort of exotic seeming masks in gift shops. And what I realized is that my friend had a mask collection. And when I was dreaming of traveling across Asia, I would look at those masks and sort of dream my way into that further trip. And after a certain point of Asia travel experience, I didn't really need those masks to certify myself as a traveler. I was having more organic experiences. And so now when I have those masks, which I still keep on the wall of my office in Kansas, I don't just think of Asia, but I think of myself as that excited newbie traveler on the continent of Asia, buying masks for reasons he doesn't completely understand.
You know, the relationship between souvenirs and the dreams that send you on journeys in the first place seems interesting to me. Like, it seems like you start with a dream and you come home with a souvenir.
Yeah, yeah. I was just talking to a high school teacher who brought back a Dia de los Muertos mask from Mexico, and he put it in his classroom. And he said it really sparked his students' interest. And I think it's interesting that as wannabe travelers, oftentimes we're inspired not just by the idea of other places, but by these concrete physical objects of other places. I mean, you have National Geographic famously and makes people dream of other places. But I think when you're young and you see these objects that have been brought home by your elders, or you visit a friend's house and see the uncle who served in the military and brought back this, you know, really curious carving from another continent, that really makes the idea of other places seem real. And even in the 21st century, when we get so many images from places like Instagram, there's something to be said for holding an object from a faraway place and really using it as a way of dreaming yourself into that place. I keep using that word dreaming, but it's a recurring thing as I've explored the phenomenology of souvenirs, is that it's really used as an object that's bigger than its singular self.
Yeah, you write some about the word souvenir and the fact that it's a French verb, actually. Like, we use it as a noun, a thing, but the French verb to remember, it literally means to come back to yourself.
Yeah, yeah. And so that sort of made its way into English about the time that Jefferson and Adams were carving chips off of Shakespeare's chair, around the time of, you know, when the Industrial Revolution was sparking up, and souvenirs became a really formalized ritual in the tourist industry. But if you go to cemeteries like Père Lachaise in France, you'll actually see the word souvenir on tombstones, because it's about people go to remember their relatives. And so it's only in English that it has a more singular purpose, as these objects that we collect that are sort of an agent of memory. And a given object will serve memory in different ways over the course of a given lifetime.
You know, when you mentioned photographs, that is such a big part of how most people do remember travels and remember just important experiences. But I've read about the science of how remembering something through a photograph works, that when you look at this photograph again and again, the path you take back to that memory kind of gets set in stone, and it becomes hard to remember things about the experience outside the photograph. Like, the photograph becomes a stand-in for the experience. And I wonder if it is different when you're looking at a less literal thing, like a clamshell.
Yeah, well, it's more associative. And I forget, Annie Dillard or maybe Susan Sontag wrote really interestingly about how we're looking at the photograph, but we're also remembering the last time we remembered the photograph, right? And it has... A photograph has a direct one-to-one relationship with what is being viewed, whereas a snow globe or a wood chip or a clamshell picked up from the shores of Lake Michigan, it has a different kind of energy that you can't just show it to somebody and say, look, this is what I saw. It has a personalized meaning. And in the book, I talk about how when Neil Armstrong, the astronaut, died, his estate found that he had saved some wrenches and waist tethers from his moon mission that I think to him told a story that was completely different than all the millions of words that have been written about the moon mission. And so I think that's really something about the power of souvenirs to call forth these associative memories that even a photograph can't stand in for.
So in an age of mass-produced souvenirs, how is that the same as carving off your own wood chip or bringing back your wrench? I mean, you write about the gazillions of Eiffel Tower souvenirs that a person can pick up in Paris, for example. Is that the same as your wood chip carving?
It is and it isn't, you know, and it created this authenticity discussion. I dedicate an entire chapter to the idea of authenticity. Is like, is this little trinket that was made in China that depicts a French landmark, is that an authentic representation of experience? And actually, you know, those aristocratic travelers who carved off wood chips from Shakespeare's chair were really irritated by the middle-class travelers who came in. One is that there were so many of them that they would destroy those chairs. And two is that they really created a market in trinkets, whereas an aristocratic traveler through his education might buy fine crystal or tapestry that was informed by his education in a certain place like Milan. A middle-class traveler didn't care. They would take a trinket that was engraved with the word Milan, and this still happens. But I think in my investigation of souvenirs, I realized that the authenticity that travelers seek really isn't about cultural authenticity, but about a sense of authenticity in oneself, about being away from home. And oftentimes, it's the first-time travelers, it's the early explorers who buy the trinkets. But in a way, the first time we visit a place like Milan has an emotional power that might be stronger than our more sophisticated self that visits a place like Milan for the 10th time. So as much as we might make fun of the little trinkety, kitschy-type souvenirs, snow globes and keychains and such... In a way, it doesn't matter, because it's all about the meaning it conveys for the person who went there. And when you think about going to a place like Paris, for a person who's been there for the first time, I think it reminds you of the miracle of crossing an ocean and seeing a place that you've dreamt about your whole life. So in a way, for as much as we might look down our nose at some of the cheaper type souvenirs, it doesn't really matter what purpose they serve as a social status, because it's all a very internal and personalized thing.
You know, I mean... It's interesting to me to think about how all of the memories of your travels come back to you in Kansas, but also when you talk about authenticity and you know, I don't know, being away, far away from home, it sounds almost like buying souvenirs and trying to find an authentic souvenir is really about trying to make sure you haven't lost who you are, that you're still a real person and not just lost in the identity of tourist. You know what I mean? Is that, as a travel writer, I mean, do you feel like you need to be reminded that you are still the you from Kansas?
Sometimes, yeah. You know, like if I buy or even just pick up a souvenir that I know where it's going to be in my house, you know, sort of part of this object narrative I have back home, it's sort of a connection to the place I've left behind. And a lot of people who've researched souvenirs and the people who buy them, the ritual of shopping for souvenirs or looking for souvenirs is sort of a comfort ritual in a place that you don't completely understand. You can find a containable part of it to hold to yourself. And in a place that you might only be for a few days, that has so many more things than you could possibly remember, taking one little part of it, even if it's just a cheap keychain or you know, an empty wine bottle from a fun experience you had, then that's a way of keeping and honoring what is in essence an ephemeral experience.
But for all of your acceptance and even sort of honoring of souvenirs, you do have an entire chapter on souvenirs and human suffering.
Yeah, I wanted to acknowledge that because there's sort of a lightheartedness to travel souvenirs, but over the course of many centuries of warfare and also some very ugly chapters in American history involving lynching, cutting off bodily souvenirs, scalps, fingers, which are not meant to be enshrined and kept, but sort of speak to the psychopathy of a lynching event or a war battle, it really creates a complicated situation. And it's something I explore in that chapter. Like, if you go to a place like Auschwitz, what do you bring back as a souvenir? And the gift shops in Auschwitz have been wrestling with that. Actually, the gift shop at the 9/11 Memorial in New York has wrestled with that, is that how do you honor something that's very solemn at the same time, you know, giving the visitors a tangible thing to remember it with. And I also bring up Mount Vernon.
I'm curious why you think that places like that do have gift shops. I mean, if the experience is so solemn, maybe the place itself is the memory.
Well, you would think so, but a refrain I heard often again and again is that the reason souvenirs are offered, or the reason a certain type of souvenir is offered, is because that's what people want. And, you know, when Auschwitz stopped selling souvenirs, people started stealing parts of Auschwitz. They started taking bits of barbed wire and brick. And so it became a very complicated thing where they're actively trying not to disturb the solemn atmosphere of the place, but people somehow weren't happy with just a memory of this solemn place. They wanted something to make the sorrow of this place very, very strong. And so that's one of the things that I explore. Also the idea that men who are in battle will go to great lengths to bring back little mementos of war, often risking their lives. And it's often, an analyst said it, as a way of reminding themselves that they will once again have this normal domestic life. So it's a really complicated thing. It could almost be its own book. But I wanted to acknowledge that amid the more frivolous and whimsical souvenirs, that there are some very, very serious souvenir rituals out there.
You know, it's interesting that the more you talk about this, I think I've always had this idea of souvenirs as a commercially driven thing, but it sounds like it is just a deep human impulse.
It is, and it goes back to childhood, when we sort of identify the world by picking things up and holding them in front of our face, or even showing them to older people. And so I think... Show and tell, yeah. And I don't think I fully appreciated that until I went through my house and realized how many souvenirs I had that I don't even think of as souvenirs. They're just sort of ways of organizing the world and my life's journeys through it.
Can you, on the way out, tell us about one little souvenir you have?
Is there a specific one you have in mind?
Nope.
Or are you okay? Free association. Well, I am a Kansas City Royals baseball fan, and I have a little shrine of baseballs and ephemera, especially from the 2014-15 season. I realize it's not a travel souvenir, but it has an emotional strength, as any Kansas City Royals fan would attest.
Yeah. Well, Ralph Potts, our time is up. Thank you so much.
Good to talk to you, Gina.
Ralph will be giving a reading in Lawrence on April 13th at the Raven Bookstore. His new book is called Souvenir, and that's a wrap. You can listen back to anything you heard on today's show or anything you missed at kcur.org/Central Standard. Tomorrow, tune in for a portrait session with Suniana Dumala, When her husband was shot last year in an Olathe bar, she implored us for a reason why she should stay here. As it turns out, she has stayed. We'll hear her story tomorrow at 10. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from intern Matt Groby. I'm Gina Kaufman, and I also host a podcast called Midwesternish. That's Midwesternish. It's a lot of fun. Up to date is next. Stay tuned.